Welcome to Failing Up, a podcast where we explore failure.
Why we're afraid of it, why we try to avoid it, and the success that can arise directly from it.
Failure comes in many shapes and forms. It can even mean different things to different people.
This show, Failing Up, intends to explore all aspects. These are the stories of people who have experienced profound failures that ultimately led them to something positive.
We hope this helps us all learn and grow. Thanks for listening.
My name is Eden.
And I'm Guy.
Duncan, is it Burning? Shit. I can't pronounce it.
So. It's Burning Man.
Duncan Burning Man. Yes. Can I just say Burning Man?
I like Duncan Burning Man.
I think you should run with it.
It's just like the city, neither of which I've been to.
So you don't pronounce the
you
H?
You haven't been to Birmingham?
Birmingham.
No, you pronounce the H.
Yeah. Okay, that's Birmingham. What really question.
I haven't been to the one in England. I haven't been to the one in Alabama.
There is one in Alabama.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there's a Hamlet in Ireland. I haven't been there either.
Does that mean your family's from any of those places?
I'm told we're from, most people are like, oh, so you're English? And my dad insisted we were Irish. So I have been to Ireland. We didn't go to the Hamlet of Birmingham. Now, who knows how many, you know, generations of Birminghams were in Ireland. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm assuming they came from England at some point.
Right.
But growing up, I was always told I was half Irish. The other half's Italian. But yeah, it's a mouthful.
Have you guys seen all those commercials lately for like Ancestry.com where they take your DNA and swab it?
Yeah,
that kind of stuff is, I'm starting to feel like I should do that.
I just saw one this morning, and they were like, I thought I was Italian. Turns out I'm from Swahili or so. I don't know.
I saw something where they did it with like, I don't want to say racist, but like people who were like, I am 100% white, blah, blah, blah. And then they get the things like, no, you're actually from Africa. Did you know that? Like 60, and they're crying and all that stuff. And I'm like,
You're actually a black Jew.
Exactly.
I would pay for some racist to get their heritage done.
Right.
I don't think I really care, but I'm like, I'd like to pay for someone else and have it sent to them. And yeah.
I smell a reality show.
I'm saying, why don't we sanction?
That might have been a reality show. Didn't Ben Affleck get in trouble? It was like celebrity heritage, and they would go on a tour, and then Ben Affleck, I can't remember.
Actually.
There was something there, maybe some slave owning.
Oh,
but whatever it was edited out of the episode. Maybe it wasn't even him, but the PBS did, and then they put it back in. I'm really flying blind on that.
I don't want to smear Ben Affleck. Like, have some racists in the room and be like, okay, we will endorse the KKK as long as all of you are 100% white. And I guarantee it's like 0%. Yeah, no, nobody's 100% anything at this point.
I think Donald Trump is like 100% ham. Just entirely.
Here's another
100% honey baked ham.
His father insisted that they were Swedish when he was German because he was trying to sell Jews homes. So
no pictures of Donald Trump online with a shirt off. Those do not exist.
I
deep Googled. You cannot find it. You cannot find like a beach photo or a yacht photo. Or
That's interesting.
I found one of Bernie. So that's
shirtless.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I think he was younger. I think he was doing a protest, to be quite honest.
Did you Google shirtless Bernie Sanders?
No, I Googled, I did this for Donald Trump too, because I was like curious. I was like, maybe he was hot when he was younger.
No.
Like, and no, he's horrifying throughout.
Yeah.
As a baby.
He's had that feathered hair look for many, many years.
He had it, I think he was a sperm with like a feathered thing on top. I don't know. Anyway,
yeah, even as a bald guy, that's the one guy I'm not jealous of his hair. Most everybody, like Duncan, you have a beautiful head of hair.
Thank you.
I look at people like you and I'm like, why does Duncan get to have it but not Guy? I don't know. I have the classic horseshoe,
mm-hmm.
So if I let it grow out, I look like I'm, 60, 70 years old.
I think it looks good. You guys can't see it at home, but I'm seeing a Bruce Willis type. If I had no hair, I feel like my head would not have a good shape, so I feel like that's nature's way of protecting my misshapen head.
I've done some stand-up before, and one of my jokes is about that very same thing, because when I make jokes about my baldness, there's always like a girl that goes, well, at least you have a nice round head.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
oh, I thought in she was gonna say, world, at least you have a nice personality.
No, but either way, in what world do compliments start with the words at least?
Yeah, that's true.
Not a compliment. Right. Don't at least. That's not saying something nice to me. That's still an insult.
I have a feeling you're going to cut all this part out.
No, I'm just going to let it go. Duncan, where'd you grow up?
I grew up in a combination of, I lived in Boston for many years.
Okay.
And then my dad had a midlife crisis. We moved down to Florida. which is usually a nice conversation stopper. yeah, I lived in Florida for 6 years, went to high school down there in South Florida, and yeah, it was as weird as people say.
You were weird.
Florida was weird.
Oh, Florida was weird. Okay. Like the news reports and all that.
Yeah, the news reports. I feel like, you know, South Florida is very nice. It was just, you know, where people go for spring break. It's where a lot of people go when they kind of want to just like give up. It's where people go, you know, stockbrokers
go. Is that the rock bottom of America? Like people just like.
I don't know if I don't get it down there. I guess because some people do think it's paradise. For me, it's really hot and sweaty. Unless you are a Jimmy Buffett type who likes really loves boating and blender drinks and scuba diving. Like I don't see the appeal.
It sounds like a Cabo Cantina.
It's a little Cabo Cantina.
Yeah. Like everywhere.
Talk about raining every day. Florida definitely has that going for it every single day. And then did you go to college in Boston?
I went to college in upstate New York.
Oh, upstate
very York. Far upstate New York. Tiny school. No one's ever heard of it. Viggo Mortensen went there.
Which time?
I saw him.
Probably applied to
it. It's called St. Lawrence.
Oh, it's cute, because I almost went to Sarah Lawrence.
Oh, okay. See, that's what people will say. That's you went thinking. To Sarah Lawrence? Isn't that a girl's school? And I was like, no, it's not a girl's school anymore. And that's not where
and
I went.
It wasn't a girl.
It's been like 40 years. It has
been a girl's school. Went there. People are like, isn't it a girl's school? It's like, no, there is two guys that go there. Yeah. It's not a girl's school.
How did you choose your school?
I think more my school chose me out of the places I probably applied. I think my high school in Florida, every couple of years, someone would go there. Or every year, a couple people would go there. I also had done this Outward Bound trip the year before, and all of a sudden, I was thinking I was going to be like this nature person. Like I was like, I'm done with cities.
Really?
I'm all about the outdoors. That didn't last long.
Were you a bad student?
I was not a good student. Not a good student. I was good in English, good in history, couldn't pass a math class, couldn't pass a science class. Like a lot of people who work in Hollywood.
Yeah, I feel like that's like me, basically.
Right, so where did you end up going? So you said no Sarah Lawrence.
I said no to Sarah Lawrence. I felt I liked that I got in because they don't look at SAT scores, and my SAT scores were great on the English, but like math, I completely ruined it.
Yeah.
And like I think they just gave me some points because they felt bad on math. So I ended up going to UC Santa Barbara.
Beautiful.
Because it was cheaper too, a lot cheaper. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get into UCLA because I wasn't Asian enough. And they didn't go in my ancestry and check that out for me. So, but yeah, I did not like any of my, I basically failed all my math classes and biology classes. And yeah, so that wasn't my
Wait,
thing.
Did you answer where you ended up?
Oh, UC Santa Barbara, which was like a big party school at the time.
Yeah.
But then again, it still has the most Nobel laureates teaching there.
Wow.
And I have a feeling that they just teach there because they want to retire. And that's where everybody goes to retire. Like Santa Barbara is completely old people and students. That's all there is. I wouldn't want to live there ever. And Oprah.
Well, maybe when you're old.
I've been to Santa Barbara a few times. I really like it. I don't feel like I've tapped into whatever's. I feel like I'm always at a bar and all of a sudden it becomes a college bar. And I'm like, where do people who are...
There's no in-betweeners.
Okay. It didn't feel like they're in-betweeners.
I actually dropped out of college, too, because I couldn't handle Santa Barbara, the weirdness, and I don't know.
Yeah. Who needs it?
Yeah.
Who
when you're going to college, how about before college, what do you think you want to do for a living?
Because of the fact that I failed every math and science class, I was on a writing track very early on.
Terrible
athlete. It was like, you know, everything else crossed off the list. There was nothing else besides writing. Worked at the school newspaper, did the Lit Mag. Did a little acting, but that was like what I did in college. I worked at the Weekly World News, World's Wildest Tabloid, which is in Florida. Elvis Stories, Bat Boy Stories. I was their Bigfoot expert.
We saw that.
Were you an intern for Rolling Stone first?
I was an intern for Rolling Stone after. Weekly World News was kind of in high school and in college.
How do you get involved with the Weekly World News? You were their Bigfoot expert.
I was their Bigfoot expert. It was when we were doing a hunt for Bigfoot, $1 million bounty, but you had to bring him in alive, not dead, because this was for science. So they were really nice. This was probably the first year of college. This was summer, and they let me do all the radio shows and all the promos for this big, like, Bigfoot hunt, probably because no one else really wanted to.
Yeah.
I had a neighbor who worked for the National Enquirer, so he knew I wanted to get into journalism. That's where people go to, like, end their journalism career and, like, cash out. So that's where I went to start mine. And I did one summer at the National Enquirer. I'm dating myself, but it was the two big bombshells that summer. were Julia Roberts, Lyle Lovett getting married. And then when Burt Reynolds and Lonnie Anderson split up,
yes.
and like Burt was like on a very first name basis with people at the Enquirer, he would just call and be like, how much for these photos? Like, how much for this? That type
wow.
of stuff.
Wow.
But then when I went back, I liked the weirdos on kind of this side building who did the Weekly World News. It's just like 20 people. And then shit. I did a couple of summers.
Were they
there.
Related? National Enquirer?
They were. They okay. were. It's all the same. Same company. And then in college, I took pictures of all my roommates and friends, sent them into the Weekly World News. I think we'd both get like $40 and they'd be in the magazine as, you know, someone who was mauled by Bigfoot or like migrant workers mauled by a citrus monster. Or like my college roommate got his gave his liver to Princess Diana, stuff like that.
So there's no, I love this whole topic. There's no semblance when you're working there of like, any reality. It doesn't matter.
At the Enquirer, there's a lot of, you know, things run by lawyers and stuff like that. At the Weekly World News, there is a disclaimer in there. So there is a lot of stuff, you know, that just falls under satire. Although, then they'll put a lot of real stories in there, real weird stories from the Associated Press. So it is kind of hard to find which ones are true and which ones are
false. So are you literally sitting at home like, let me make up a quote for this Bigfoot story, and like you're saying, you're taking pictures of your roommate, so this is completely made up. These are stories you made up.
These are made up stories. We're pitching them to can't remember my boss's name, who's no longer with us, Eddie, this guy who was hilarious, this like older southern gentleman. And it was almost kind of like a little bit of a comedy writing room thing, you know. We're
feel like
putting
this is a comedy
the putting
yeah,
the
exactly.
putting the pitches in his basket
How's
and stuff.
The story.
It was basically that. It was a good group of people. I don't know. I feel like it's online, but I don't even think they make the paper anymore.
So you could just walk in and be like, okay, aliens came down. They ate a cow and they cut out open an L shape in it. And
too much. Reel it in a little. Something like that. And we had group. There were people that would show up at the, you know, at the offices. We had like a lot of security there because there were a lot of people that read the stories and wanted to meet the aliens and did take it, you know, as gospel truth.
Oh my gosh! Yeah, you must have
That's
had the
a
conspiracy
very lucrative opportunity though. Yeah. Like you could have sold like. Look, this alien like took a bite out of the sandwich. Don't you want to buy it on eBay and like
to the mentally ill people like in the parking lot? I know. I kind of missed that opportunity. I guess I missed that boat.
But what's your attitude though? Like, are you thinking when you're doing this, like, oh, this is just a, you know, a little blip in my life? You think, hey, I could actually make a living out of this?
I felt like probably I didn't have much of a game plan. I think I worked in newspapers and then I did some like regular newspapers after that. And I did that because I wanted to write novels and authors that I liked. Like that was something they did, you know, back then. Now I'm really dating myself. Like people worked, like Hemingway worked in a newspaper and stuff like that. Right. It just felt like good experience. And the Weekly World News thing was something I just like lucked into.
Does that actually get you into a newspaper or do you hide that from the newspaper?
I mentioned it because I was like young enough where it was like, this was like my summer job and like my after school job for, you know, a couple years. So, you know, they knew I knew stuff about editing and layouts and stuff like that. So that was helpful. And then when I went to Rolling Stone, I actually did a terrible job there because the other places I got paid and got to write. Rolling Stone, I was like, it was like very corporate and I was very naive and everyone was very hip and cool and I was just a goofball. And I have this like ID from my Rolling Stone like intern ID and the picture's so terrible. My hair is like plastered across my face. I'm wearing this like pressed button down and I'm just like nobody there wanted to work with me.
What year was that you were at?
That was 97. That was right after college.
Okay, so Rolling Stone was still a huge deal at that point.
Yeah.
I mean, in the 2000s, it's kind of fallen off. I think once they went smaller, I feel like that really made them. Anyway, for me, anyway, especially in that era, the 97 era, like to be a part of Rolling Stone is like a huge deal, isn't it? Did you feel that even as an intern?
When they called me, I was very excited. Like I went to New York thinking like, this is it. I'm going to, you know, own this city. Like I have so many ideas for Rolling Stone. And I just didn't have the polish or the ambition. I just didn't know how to go about like getting people interested in my stories. I think I wasn't maybe into the bands of the moment at that time. And I just wasn't the best intern. And all of a sudden I was like working at a theater, like selling tickets and going into Rolling Stone, like less and less and more just like working this other job. And then I was there for a few months being like, why am I even in New York doing this? I don't know what I'm
doing. Wow.
What
okay.
I'm,
so
I'm
Rolling
doing.
Stone was not a success.
Rolling Stone
for
wasn't
you.
My shining moment. I didn't, you know, Carpe Diem at Rolling Stone as much as I
but
should.
But obviously it led you on to other things. What happened after? What was the next big thing for you?
That depends on how you define big. Mm-hmm. I went to Boston. I hadn't lived there for a while. And then I worked in newspapers, regular newspapers. If anyone's from Boston, Cambridge Chronicle and the Somerville Journal and like the Wellesley Townsman, the Tab. places that were like shuttering under my feet. They were all closing, or they were like, they'd been bought up by this big newspaper conglomerate. So the offices were closing and they were going to have to like consolidate in like this other town, like stuff where it's just like, oh, there's no future in this. And that wasn't exactly what I was better making things up. I wasn't like a really hard hitting journalist. I remember like feeling bad, like asking people questions that would obviously be incriminating or you know, I wasn't the best guy, especially for like cop stories. Like I wasn't the hard hitting questions guy, but it was fun and it was a young crowd, but it definitely didn't feel like newspapers was where it was at.
Okay. So for you, or did you actually foresee like, hey, this is probably not gonna be the biggest thing in the future?
I mean, I that makes it sound like I'm too smart that I foresaw it. It was definitely happening. Like it was, the newspapers were just closing everywhere, mm-hmm. and people were getting paid peanuts and stuff like that. I mean, if I really wanted to do it and thought I was a great journalist and had that in my bones, I would have. But I had written a few screenplays. I was working on like a novel. I did some classes at Emerson in Boston, and that was really great. They had a campus out here, and I moved out here in 2000. Under the guise, like finishing my last credits for that program.
Yeah.
And I get very lucky. I got a job as a writer's assistant on Queer as Folk.
I remember that show.
Yeah, that was okay. A humongous show.
Big show.
So when you land it, is it a huge show already or no?
No, this was before it was on the air.
Oh, wow.
I wasn't even going to take the job. I was like, I don't want to get someone coffee. I'm going to want to work on my art, my scripts, and like bartend. I didn't realize what a good job a writer's assistant was. I took the job. It was really great. I was the only straight person on the show, season one.
I was going to say, yeah.
It was pretty, and there were a lot of like amazing fights. Oh. The showrunners had this like more of a, you know, showrunners wanted a very sexy, in-your-face show, which the British one was. People doing meth off other people's cocks and like the bathroom stall. And the writers, especially season one, were, you know, a lot more careful about how they wanted the characters to be portrayed, rightly so. They both had, you know, legitimate arguments. There were big fights. There was like a blender thrown season one. There was a fist through the wall. My name was forged on a letter to the president of Showtime.
What?
In like this letter like that said the showrunners were doing a bad, I shouldn't even say this, shitty, it's like so long ago, shitty job, and they were like incompetent. And I got called into the showrunner's office. He's like, did you sign this letter? I was like, no, I just started here 5 days ago. I don't even know.
Wow.
Yeah, I think one of the executives had been fired. I think he just had a nervous breakdown. I don't know how he thought he was going to get away with forging everyone's name in the office. Anyway, so it was a lot of good drama, and I did that for
a
season
whole
and a
show
half. I did joke I was going to have a book called The Straight Story, my season and a half at Queer as Folk.
Yes, straight as.
So, we're setting it straight.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there we go. Mm-hmm.
That's actually start that Tumblr. Is it too late, 12 years later, to do that Tumblr? And
no, go deal? For it.
I think Tumblr's the perfect place to start.
Is Tumblr still around?
What does a writer's assistant do? You said he does it. They don't go, or do they run coffee?
Not really too much coffee. I could probably speak to what a writer's assistant does now better, knowing our writer's assistants. Mm-hmm. In that case, I wasn't taking a lot of notes because there was so much like sexually explicit stuff in the room. Not everybody wanted everything recorded.
Right.
But in general, the writer's assistant's usually, you know, typing it all out, and you're looking at it on a big screen, and they're kind of typing out the pitches and taking notes as everyone's kind of trying to crack stories and stuff like that. So there's always, you know, you don't want to get on the writer's assistant's bad side because all of a sudden you're pitching out a joke and it's not making it up onto the big screen. And they're like, oh, did he hear me or not? Or did he just not like my joke? So writer's assistant,
Is that a good gig?
Like, very good gig.
Does it teach you something?
I think it teaches you how the writer's room works and like how, you know, pitching jokes works you know, how to best deal with the other writers in a way that's, you know, you don't like someone's idea, but you don't want to shit on their ideas. So you want to try and pitch something better, but not hurt their feelings, all that kind of stuff. And kind of cracking story and crafting story and how to deal with people in the room and all that stuff. And then you're in the room, and then maybe you're cracking some jokes or whatever, drama, pitching some plot lines. And then you hopefully move up the ranks. I did a different route to TV, but I think that's a good way to do it. You know, TV assistant to the writer's assistant, then you're in the room hopefully as a writer after a couple seasons.
Is there a power thing to that writer's assistant? Like at some point you're like, I get to decide what goes up on the big screen. It sounds like there is a little bit.
I think there is, although, you know, there's not supposed to be. You're supposed to be putting most stuff up there, mm-hmm. but you know, you can only type so fast. So, you know, right. I think there's a little bit of, did that joke land at all? If it didn't, maybe you don't put it up on the board. For me, the writer's assistant gig was great because that's how I met all these agents, because they would send send me submissions for Queer as Folk for their writers. And I kind of was able to find an agent through that because I was the first gatekeeper that reading these, whatever back then, like Sopranos specs and passing them on to my bosses or, you know, tossing them in the trash. So really enjoying the that power.
That's a lot of power. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How do you parlay an agent, though? Do you just start chatting with them and they're like, yeah, okay, cool.
At that point, I'd read some kind of cheesy screenwriting book, and this was probably so outdated, but I had all these index cards with an agent. I find an agent, put their name on the index card, send them the card and be like, I wrote this script. It's about this, 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 and this. Check this box and send back this self-addressed stamp postcard and I will send you the script. Because it's also, that was a legal thing too, that they would, you know, protect them. Sometimes they don't want to read scripts if, you know, if it's some random person because they don't want to get sued if something, you know, ends up in their other clients. Sell something similar. So
yeah.
That's why I think agents, it's so much a referral business. You know, they want you to be referred by another writer that they know. So mm-hmm. It's not like, who's this random person? They're going to send me their, you know, buddy swapping or body swapping movie. And then right. I wonder if I have another body swapping movie. So that was helpful to meet agents. But I do think it's about, if you have a writer friend who can kind of help you and like your script and they can pass it along. That's probably the most helpful, I think.
You know what I feel like, and tell me if this is one of the ways things have happened for you. Have you had, like, I would assume you've had friends along the way that have become successful too, right? And that's part, like, it feels like that way with writing a lot for me anyway, that you kind of like, maybe you did comedy with them first and that's how you met them, but now he's the executive producer of this show, so I got a writing job on it kind of thing. Has that kind of thing happened for you?
That definitely has.
Or are you the friend that did it for other people?
No, I definitely have, luckily, very successful friends. I used to work more in screenwriting, and as that business kind of fell apart, kind of like newspapers, because I'm not into usually comic book movies or CGI-heavy movies, so that time of like, you know, I know very few like working screenwriters anymore. So luckily I got into TV maybe 6 or 7 years ago,
yeah.
Kind of a little before the jump to TV. So especially in the world of TV, I feel like I know more and more people that I like and people who are friends with the same sensibility. And that's certainly a big thing. You know, you're in a room with somebody, they go to another job. It's always a nice, easy ask to be like, oh, maybe there's a spot for me. And, you know, you want to work with people whose taste you already know and likes. It's so hard to judge what someone's going to be like in a room pitching jokes just from reading their script.
Right. I mean, I want to talk about TV more, but I want to jump into something else really quickly. You are the author of the blog and subsequent humor book series, Pets Who Want to Kill Themselves, which is a hilarious concept.
That's a really funny concept.
And how do you make, like, well, first of all, I got to say, when I saw this, I was like, oh my God, I think I kind of have one.
Oh, I should have brought you one.
Here, this is my niece and her cat. Or whatever. It's four pictures.
Goodness.
That's the kind of general idea of pets that want to kill themselves. Like, she's hugging the cat, and the cat has a death stare on it. But yeah, see, she's smiling, and she's hugging the cat, and the cat's like, please kill me now.
The funny thing is, I've seen so many cats with that face.
I guess all cats do. But no, it's so funny. Like, I started going through the blog.
Resting cat bitch face.
You know, the cats and dogs that are dressed up to, like, the nines. And, like,
yeah.
Sometimes there's, like, two that look like they're smiling. And then there's that third that's just like, fuck this, man. Yeah. This is bullshit. And it's amazing. Like, it really makes you go, wow, animals, I think they do, right? Do you think they actually realize they're douches?
I there's something there, because that expression is like almost like universal in animals. It's kind, and that's what I would look for the blog and the book, with these pictures. The best ones were ones where the animal or the pet looked like it was like rolling its eyes and it just had this deadpan expression, and of course the owner is so like happy and filled with joy, which is the way I am with my pet. So a lot of times people would be like, are you making fun of these people? And I'd be like, no, I feel like I'm just looking for like overloved pets. And when I did do the whole thing kind of came about bizarrely. I just thought it was a funny title. I wanted to put something up on a Tumblr.
Yeah.
I didn't even have a pet at the time. A friend had sent me a Christmas card that was so ridiculous. I think that was the first post where the dog's in antlers. And I posted that and a few other pictures. And I just started to get all these submissions. I mean, it really took off. It was on the New York Magazine, the back of their Matrix, their mm-hmm. cool Matrix. I think we were pretty uncool, but
we
were on the Matrix like 2 weeks later. And then, yeah, I got this weird little book deal. It's not even a coffee table book. I'd call it more of a toilet book, so that's the size of it. And
hey,
that
that's way more red than most books.
Yes. And so I worked on a novel for years that nobody bought, and then I sold my stupid pet book very easily. But I was worried that some of the people who'd been on the blog would be worried about. I was worried people might get offended with the book, because some people are like holding their bulldogs, and I have like, you know, the captions are about them, you know, sodomizing them or this weird things like that. I was really stretching for jokes in that book a little bit. But no complaints.
Do you have to clear pictures, or is it because they sent it to you, you're allowed to use it?
I had made a little legal thing on the Tumblr. So once they sent it to me, it was all mine.
Wow. And does anybody come back, either say like, F you?
No, nobody came back. I want money. I sent a bunch of people books, and that was it. I think people were happy to have their pets in there. We were in the front page of the New York Times one day. It was a Saturday. And it was a story about, it wasn't just about pets want to kill themselves, it was about like tumblers turned books, like there was like FU Penguin and passive aggressive notes. Anyway, but the picture of this one woman would send me her dog Sadie in all these different outfits, and I mean, I kind of wish it was a picture of me, but it was a picture of Sadie in aerobics gear, and I like emailed her, I was like, go to the store, I'm not going to tell you what's there, just go pick up a New York Times right now, and she flipped out. So that was fun.
That's I want to get a phone call like that.
Right? I mean, well, you could. You have a dog. You never know.
Yeah, I don't want to dress her up like that, though.
And then I tried to sell Pets Who Want to Kill Themselves, the animated show. It was close, didn't get a buyer for it. Now I'm passing these marquees for Secret Lives of Pets. Yep. I'm like, what?
Yeah, I know.
I was thinking that, actually.
I was thinking that, too.
I wonder if... Mm-hmm. Do you wonder, seriously, like, maybe there's something?
No, it's just in the air. It's just a watered-down version of the original.
It's true. It's the Bud Light.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I don't want any of their dirty money.
Yeah, of course not. 2011, you and Marc Maron wrote a pilot, and it ended up being the basis of the show Maron. How does that all happen? How do you know Marc Maron? And did you know when you were writing that, were you essentially writing it for a pilot, or were you doing it for some other reason, which would make sense?
Doing for a pilot. I was very lucky. I didn't know Marc Maron. I just knew his stuff and was a fan. And I went into Apostle, which is Dennis Leary's management company. I went to pitch them something, and they passed on what I was pitching them, but they had already had an idea. They wanted to do something with Mark. You know, the podcast was really big. They wanted to build a show around him. I think maybe they had another writer at some point. It hadn't worked out. And they were like, do you want to meet with Mark? And I was like, I definitely want to meet with Mark. I figured they probably had a lot, you know, a lot of times, especially if a comedian's kind of known, they have a lot of different writers on it or like pitching for the job. So I met with him and we got along, felt like we had the same taste. So it was a very nice, painless, really easy process, and they just wanted to do maybe a 10-minute little pilot presentation just to kind of give the tone of the show, see what he would be like, that kind of thing. They didn't even initially know if they wanted everything to be linear. I felt like since they were going to pay to shoot this thing, that we may as well write something that was linear and felt like it was, you know, a real pilot. So we ended up writing almost pretty much a full pilot, and it was really fun. Took 2 days to shoot. I think it was like very low budget, $30,000, shot it at his house in Highland Park, and he was in it, obviously, and Ken Jeong was in it. Ed Asner came, played his dad. Angela Trimber was in it. Matt Jones. God, who else was in it? Luke Matheny, who just won an Oscar for his short film, directed it. And it was, it was super cool. So they shopped that around. I was kind of out of the process, didn't know what was going to happen. They shopped it around to networks. And then, 6 months later or something, IFC bought it. And that was great.
I mean, because we all know, anybody who's been in this area, in Hollywood, that kind of thing, there are lots of pilots. There are lots of pilots written. Then fewer are actually made into the actual pilot, right? Are filmed for a pilot. And then out of those, a handful get smoke blown up their ass, where everybody who has this gets to this level, it's like, definitely, this is happening. And then, like, a smidgen of those actually get the TV show. So was there belief, like how many, had you written pilots before? Like, did you have belief that this was going to happen, or was it an actual surprise for you?
I'd written a bunch before, like maybe, like I said, like did movie stuff, like sold movie scripts, but got nothing made. And then like maybe 2009, started working in TV, sold some things, nothing was getting made. Well, this seemed like it had a better shot because it was a show built around Marc Maron, who was, you know, podcast was really blowing up and everyone was very interested in him, I think, to do a show. Plus the idea that the guys at Apostle had to film something, mm-hmm. I think was great. So either way, it was like we were making a pilot. So that was exciting.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure what was going to happen. It did feel like to me that everything was set up. It was mine to lose or to fail as far as working on the scripts. It felt like all the pieces were in place. So it felt like we had a good shot. I mean, I guess there's the little bit of, you know, Louis's already out there and there are shows built around comedians. So you're fighting that. But the fact that this is a show with someone with a very, you know, different story. There's all this darkness and, you know, drugs and addiction and ex-wife and the fact that there's the podcast is like built into the show felt like a really good hook. So I had high hopes for it.
Okay, so you had foresight. I mean, because to me, I'm thinking this is before podcasts are getting more and more mainstream. 2011, they really weren't that mainstream. And for you to have foresight and go, oh yeah, this is probably going to me, that's surprising. I'd be like, it's a show that has a podcast in it. People aren't even listening to podcasts. Are they going to watch a podcast?
Well, I might be making it sound sunnier, my optimism. Sorry. I mean, I was probably just not even caring. I was excited that someone was paying me something and interested in me writing anything. So yeah. I'm just going to go ahead and do it no matter what. I'm just going to forge ahead.
And is 6 months a long time to wait, or is that pretty average as far as...
I think if it was even a longer time.
Oh, wow.
We did get to show it. It was really fun. We showed it in New York, the New York TV Film Festival, which is a really cool festival. They have a lot of open submissions for people that aren't Writers Guild represented. I always recommend it to people who are writing pilots. So we, you know, at least I got to see it on a big screen and it got a good reaction. Maybe it was even more than that. It definitely felt like it took a while. I felt like when I got the phone call that the show was happening, I might have written off a little bit. I felt like a little worried because I hadn't heard from anyone and I was out of the loop. I wasn't part of the kind of pitching process.
So even when you get the show, you're like, oh, okay, sure.
Well, no, when they called about it, then I was very excited.
Oh, then you're like, okay, this is awesome. Okay, that makes more sense. And so you wrote for them for, was it three seasons?
I did it for two seasons, and then I kind of consulted on the last two. Really didn't have much to do with this last season. I wrote one last year. You know, I would have loved to have written for all of them. You never kind of know if the show is coming back or if they want to still do the show. This other show, Blunt Talk, just happened to come along when I was on hiatus. And Jonathan Ames, I was a fan because I like his books, and I liked Bored to Death, so I happened to hop on that show. But... you know, Maron, and this week he announced he's not going to do anymore. So obviously I was sad, just even as a viewer, because I really like the show. Mm-hmm. But I can see, you know, it's how many episodes, 55 or something like that. I can see it being taxing. And who knows, maybe he'll come back Louis style or something. But I mean, it was great. We filmed in a house near his house. We filmed all over Highland Park. We had, you know, a very small writing staff and great directors, great guest stars, and it was very kind of indie film, 3 days an episode, and it was awesome. We used different cats, not his cats.
Do you have a favorite memory from the show?
Oh, geez.
Or a favorite guest, or a least favorite guest. Ooh, I don't know if you'd give us the least favorite guest,
well,
though.
No, I might. Let me think. I don't know if I have. I mean, driving over here, I was thinking of Danny Trejo, because we're near Trejo's Tacos, right? I was thinking of going there after. Yeah. I mean, Danny Trejo was great, because that was, I think, the first week. So I was very, green on set. I didn't know what was going on. And I had written the Danny Trejo episode, and he showed up, and... I heard him through the mics being like, oh, who's this writer? Why do I have all these lines? I'm going to kill this guy. Like, I think he's used to coming in. He's got a few catchphrases. He blows someone away.
Right.
And you know, Mark's a chatty guy. So usually the show is very, you know, dialogue heavy. And that episode, hopefully not too much, was, you know, Danny Trejo has a lot of lines. And he's a guy that Mark meets in outside AA. And, you know, we kind of wrote it for him a little bit, you know, but yeah. Anyway, he was kind of awesome. And also walking down the street with him in Highland Park was like walking with like the mayor, like people were just like stopping dead in their tracks. This woman like jumped into his arms and started kissing his face.
Wow.
And was like, oh my God, so good to see you. Oh my God, where have you been? What have you been up to? What are you doing right now? Okay, will you meet me for a drink? Will you meet me for a drink? I'm going to go in here. And she like disappeared and he doesn't drink. And I was like, who is that? And he's like, I don't know. And I was like, well, he was just like used to like beautiful women just like falling into his arms, and he had like a posse. I don't know. He was awesome.
That's amazing.
God, who else do we have that was good? I mean, Judd Hirsch was cool because I was a big fan of Taxi. Yeah. And Sally Kellerman was Mark's mom. She was really sweet. She was on all the time. She would have great stories about like Robert Altman and Marlon Brando, like old school stories. So wow. She was very cool to have on. David Koechner was great in the way that I love guests that come in and they're there for lunch and they like entertain during lunch. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? They're on the whole time and it's just like such a breath of fresh air. And they're like, oh God, the whole day's over because they just like come in and are super fun.
Don't you wonder about when those people leave? Are they like, oh, I was too much today? Or like, or were they like, I was awesome today? I wondered.
I don't know. I would think you would think, that went well. I don't know because it was like the same energy at lunch that it was in on camera. Johnny Knoxville came and he took a gun out of his waistband in the middle of the filmed podcast. So I'm assuming that was a fake gun. We ended up using that, but I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Yeah, and then you make it cool. Seem like you just fell into blunt talk.
Yeah, it does make you. It seems like you just like just
rolled out of bed and there was blunt talk.
Oh, there was blunt talk and just fell into blunt. Well, I only meant that like I wasn't looking for, you know, I wasn't like. I wasn't trying to not work on mm-hmm. Maren. I was just like, is it coming back? You know, they send you on a few meetings.
Yeah.
The agents, and I met with Jonathan, who's a real character. We met at the Sunset Tower Bar, which is where he wanted to film the opening scene of the show, even though we ended up filming it downtown. And it just seemed like
I'm a big fan of Bored to Death. Oh, okay. So I would have been like, I want to see what this show's about.
Yeah, and the fact that he's a novelist and I know his books and like I'm like a failed novelist. So I was like, you can have all these literary jokes. And my favorite part of Bored to Death was, you know, Ted Danson's mm-hmm. character and his dialogue. And so there's an element of like, so this Walter Blunt character, this Patrick Stewart character, is almost going to be like an element of that Ted Danson egomaniac character at the center of the show, which seemed really cool.
Yeah.
And you know, I love Patrick Stewart. And then once I signed on, we got like this dream cast, like that I just watched Doll and M, and we got Dolly Wells, and I love Tim Sharp since like in Eva Undeclared and then and Enlightened, and so we got him and Jackie Weaver. Anyway, it was just a big, you know, it was a very different animal, lots of moving parts and big sets and stuff. So Stars coming in, I don't know if it's September or October, Blunt Talk season 2, check it out.
Is it uncomfortable? Plug. Yes, but we'll make sure to repeat that again, but is it uncomfortable to like to have the conversation then with Maren or the team for Maren and say, hey, I kind of got this other thing while we weren't sure, or do you not have that conversation?
No, we had that conversation. I mean, I think they understood. I mean, they were nice. Mark was nice enough to let me come and do another, write an episode, season 3. So, you know, he
can't be that mad.
People are going off to do other things and he's doing other things. And, you know, so.
But you're like an OG, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So well, you know, that they did just fine with, you know, he's got plenty of stories and
managed
stuff,
to go on without you. Yeah, kind of thing. Does that hurt at all?
A little
like,
bit.
What?
Little
it didn't bit. Stop because I left. So I've heard, maybe I shouldn't say it, but I'll just say. Heard mixed reviews on Patrick Stewart. Some people say he's amazing, and some people say he's kind of a dick. And so would you be honest and tell us?
I would. I think I've been pretty honest this podcast. Yeah, Patrick Stewart is great. I mean, I guess if he was really awful, I could say something.
Does he make you call him sir?
I'm very surprised you've heard negative things. No, he doesn't make. He's very fun. He's very loose. There was one day where we were filming, and I was like, I saw like a tweet that he was getting, and it was I'm so unhappy. I think it was like maybe Q-Tip, and it was like this. It was like, hey, it was just like. All lingo, all hip lingo that I'd ask Patrick Stewart what this tweet meant. And it meant he just saw me in my car filming the show and we're going to hang later. Like, it's like the weekend and he's going out with like this guys from, you know, Silicon Valley and he's just lovely. He likes to, you know, enjoy a drink. He tells amazing stories about, you know, the Royal Shakespeare Company. And
I'm so glad
he's a
to hear
professional.
That.
Yeah, I think
because
I would
publicly
say,
it seems that way.
Or I just wouldn't say anything. Yeah, he's the guy that I thought he would be. And we have him. He's like running, singing, dancing. You know, he's doing a lot of things on the show. I mean, he has said this. A lot of things on the show he's never done before. Like he had a love scene with Elizabeth Shue. Hmm. You know, he's in drag this season. So there's a lot. There was a lot asked of him. Oh yeah, he's doing blow in the pilot and
yeah.
Other. So yeah, no high marks.
Okay.
The cast likes to hang, which is great.
So if you were walking down the street and you saw Patrick Stewart, he would know who you are?
Yes.
Okay, just making sure.
And if he didn't know who I was, he would pretend very well. Because really? He's very, but he would know who I was.
So the show's also produced by Seth MacFarlane, is that right?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So I think Seth and Patrick know each other from, I don't know, maybe American Dad. So they kind of hatched some idea. Then they brought Jonathan in. Jonathan kind of hatched what the show was, mm-hmm. and you know, did the hiring. So, you know, Seth's kind of, I think, there, not really at my level too much. He's kind of doing other things, but he's kind of there as the origin story and to kind of bring people in and stuff.
You have some big recurring people. Richard Lewis is a recurring. God. He's
Richard
hilarious.
Lewis is amazing.
So is Ed Begley Jr.
I'm a huge Ed Begley Jr. going back to St. Elsewhere. So to get to sit next to Ed Begley Jr. and park next to Ed Begley Jr.
Right next to him.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to drop some clout there.
What an LA
and,
problem.
And then I feel bad because we have disposable, you know, we don't have silverware. For lunch, we have the plastic stuff, so you always feel guilt. I feel guilty in front of Ed. But we have
I'm
great
using
people.
Chopsticks, Ed.
No,
I swear
wait,
to God.
Don't you have like the compostable plastic ones?
No, we don't. We don't.
Let Ed see that. Right. Like, don't make him aware of that. Is what I'm saying.
Very good. Jason Schwartzman's on the show. Yeah. He plays Duncan.
Where do you get that name from?
I know it's Brett Gelman's on a lot. He's really great. Yeah, we know it's very good.
Is Moby's also a
Moby's on playing himself. Jonathan has a very good, I think, from just Blunt Talk or from Bored to Death and just his notoriety as a novelist. There's a lot of good fans and people that want to work with him. So Mary Steenburgen's on this season. Is that a secret? I don't think that's a secret.
Do you have guest stars in mind that you would like to have on the show? And would you hey, I would really like Mary McCormick, so I'm going to write a Mary McCormick episode and then be like, is that how it works?
Yeah, oftentimes. I mean, especially if it's someone who feels like they're already in Jonathan's world from Bored to Death a little bit, then we do try and write for people like Mary Steenburgen. Yeah, I think she was in mind when we came up with that as far as a romantic interest for this season. If you're a fan of Bored to Death, I think you'll like this season. There's a little bit more of a mystery going on. Kind of a Chinatown homage. Someone is fiddling with LA's water. Might even have something to do with the drought, and the Blunt Talk team has to get to the bottom of it.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Sounds actually more like Flint.
Mm-hmm. But there's a little bit of Flint. It's topical.
That's good.
So is there any way that you would want to see on the show?
Oh, anybody want it? Yeah. Oh, God. Who'd we
Who
have?
Who would you want?
Or who's like a dream person?
Yeah.
Dream
Springsteen?
Anybody,
Springsteen would be great. I'm not sure who he would play. I don't know. We were talking about Bud Cort this year, and I was like, oh, I'd really like to have Bud Cort on the show. Oh, God. I'm trying to think of some crushes that would be good for the show. All right. I'll have to think. I got to think about that one.
All right. That's next question.
I feel like I've had... We've had a lot of, you know, people that I've liked to meet. I don't know, you guys know Stacey. I'm a little older. You know Stacey Keach?
Yes.
Okay, Stacey Keach was on. That was pretty exciting.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So let's go to this place. You had a food group that LA Weekly has chronicled.
Yes, we've been chronicled twice. I didn't know how much food stuff you guys are up to. I was listening to the Lauren Lapkus episode. Snacks and Hacks is a different podcast. So why am I listening to that?
But it's still good.
Okay. Yes, no, that's why. Actually, why I brought it up.
Please share that.
It was very good.
So now you can have them on two podcasts.
Snacks and Hacks was good.
So what is this food group?
The food group, your listeners probably already know because we're so huge. The Culinaires are LA's manliest food group. We are culinary explorers. We all have explorer food mashup nicknames. I'm Marco Pollo. After midnight, I become Marco Pollo Loco. There's Veal Parmstrong. There's Prawns de Leon.
That's so funny. Oh, I don't know why I didn't think of something like that.
Chris Tofu Columbus was one of our guests. Oh my God, who else is there? There's more. They're in the article. Anyway, we go out, try and go to places that are, you know, kind of a little beyond the Jonathan Gold type spots, you know, but sometimes we end up at Jonathan Gold spots, but places that are a little bit off the beaten path, maybe they have something kind of challenging to eat, and we go there.
Challenging as in like super daring, like you know, I don't know.
What's that place called? There's a
elephant
food place.
Testicles or like...
Little, right, or like eat like the that. Biggest sandwich and you get your name on the wall kind of thing.
Both. Probably a little bit more the elephant testicles.
Okay.
And then there's also, usually we bring a special guest, and then there's also usually a shitload of drinking. So there's a lot. There's a lot there. So for an average, you know, the LA Weekly's been out with us twice. Let's see, the last time they went out with us, kind of a typical one was we went a couple months ago. We went, took the train down to Little Saigon, Orange County, went to a taco truck, went to a bar, went to this place. The destination was Deep Balut, which is like a duck embryo.
Hmm.
Really, I found it very hard to eat. You tap
like
it open.
Like out of an actual egg.
Exactly, an actual egg. You scoop it out, and there's like feathers. There's a little bit of a crunch. There's like the dried egg yolk around it. Plus, we're like eating alligator and clams and
queasy
pig's feet and stuff. Somebody threw up under the table.
Oh.
Beef Erickson.
It's kind of like the Seinfeld episode where he like throws up, spits in his like pocket or like handkerchief, puts in.
I remember that. I remember that. Yeah, and then the dog.
Grandma Memma.
Yeah.
It was a lot, everybody ate it.
So you're like an Andrew Zimmern. Is he an idol?
Yeah, I'm more Anthony Bourdain. Okay. I like to.
Have you tried what's the fruit that's supposed to be the most disgusting, stinky fruit? It's called
durian.
Durian. Have you?
Oh no, no, we haven't had durian.
Yeah, durian.
No.
Wow, you should try it.
Okay, you guys might have to come out with a culinaris. Where do I get durian?
Well, I saw one actually at the Japanese market.
Yes.
Uh-huh. It smelled already bad.
Yeah. It's supposed to smell like.
But I heard it didn't taste good.
No, I heard it doesn't taste good
so
either.
What's the point of it?
It's like an acquired. It's like kimchi, you know. It's like an acquired
taste.
I love kimchi.
I love kimchi too. I dump kimchi
acquired
on everything now.
I do too.
Chars that are great.
They're really big on kimchi, like huge on kimchi. Like there's all these local kimchi growers, and I bought one. This is crazy. I got like a $15 jar of kimchi, and it was like a live probiotic kimchi fermented. And I ate the whole thing in the sitting.
Whoa.
Like this jar of it.
God.
I know.
How'd you feel after that?
I was hoping that, this is better than, those yogurts that Jamie Lee Curtis is telling me to
true
eat, right? Yeah, it was good, but I had a little bit of a tummy ache.
Yeah, I've noticed a trend in my eating where if something's healthy, I'll go way overboard and make myself sick. Like, I had, a tofu peppered steak thing that I fried up the other night, and I put all the sauerkraut on it, and then I had some beans, and I was like, oh, this is a healthy meal.
It's a lot
meal
of good food, but it's too much good
I
food.
I ate an enormous frying pan of it. I thought I was going to die.
Sometimes it's good just to have the bad stuff for you, just because you know that you'll stop.
Mentally, you're like, all right, well, this was a lot of steak for one person.
Right.
But this was I was like, this is tofu. I can eat as much tofu pepper steak as I want. It's just tofu.
When you go to these restaurants, do you look at what their rating is before you go?
Oh, no. No, no. And if we did, we'd only go if it was a C or minus.
Okay, see, that's my question. You will go to a C-rated restaurant?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Jonathan Gold almost looks for C-rated restaurants.
Oh, my God. Have you read, what a C-rated restaurant means?
But it's not so bad. They get closed. They get shut down if you're below a C.
Okay.
So that's good.
There was a Vietnamese place that my friend went to, and it was a C. So we went and looked. What were the violations? Mm-hmm. It was things like chicken blood falling into a meat thing, cleaning sink used as a mop sink. Really awful things. And I'm like, I don't even think I would go to a B anymore after reading what. C's are perfect.
Yeah, I mean, now I'm getting grossed out. I've never read them. I guess the idea is, in my mind, it's like, well, if I was traveling, I don't know what the hell the rating is. So we'd kind of go anywhere.
You ever get sick?
It's like playing Russian roulette with your stomach.
Yeah, the last two times I have gotten pretty sick, but I think that was also because I was drinking for 12 hours. So it's hard to tell which is which. So it was really bad. So the Blue place, that was still, then we went to another bar, then we took a train home, then we did pizza, then it was just a long evening. We usually bring someone with us, and so far we have a long list of guests.
I bet.
Want to go. And I think Patrick Stewart is on that list.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
He wants to go with. Where would you wouldn't take him to a C-rated restaurant, though.
I would. I would totally take him.
What's the best?
I don't know if he's actually said he wants to go with, but I think he would like it. I would ask.
What do you think the best? Maybe you don't want to give it away, but try it. Whatever. Yeah. It's a small podcast. What's the best restaurant that nobody knows of in LA?
Oh, man. I would give away secrets.
Or what's one of your favorites?
Well, I will say we went out. We've been talking with a few people about maybe doing a culinary reality show. So we went out with this young Turk.
What's going on?
Uh-oh, what's happening out there?
Should I, it's just the
motorcycle taking off?
Yeah.
Hot stuff.
Okay, so you were saying your favorite place to eat.
Well, I will say the one place we've gone twice as culinaires, the only place is Jabu Do, which is, I mean, people know about it, but maybe not everyone knows about it. It's Korean seafood. You do it right on the grill, so you're like throwing down uni and clams and octopus and stuff like that. And we've been there. The sparks are coming up burning your shirt. Have you been there?
I've heard of it. Okay. And my friend told me she actually singed her eyebrows or something. Yeah.
There's you're wearing like a white glove so you can knife into the oysters. And so that's a favorite. And the place with the balut, even though the balut wasn't delicious, the food was really good. And that's in Little Saigon in Orange County. And it was called Cafe Artiste. And that was, I mean, that was pretty locals only.
I'm trying to think of Little Saigon. Is that Garden Grove?
Garden Grove. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So I didn't know that area at all.
It's not that far away. Now I know where I'm going to go for food.
So well, maybe. The C rating.
Right. We'll see what they're.
Oh, right. Yeah. I don't know. I got to feel like they're probably a solid C. Yeah. The culinaries have been as far as Tijuana. I think the next trip is going to be Vegas, but we're going to go right past the casinos into Thai Town.
Dude, I think you should go to Hawaii.
I would love to go to Hawaii.
Now that I've been there and I've tried the cuisine and I had poke from a gas station, I think it's time.
It's a place to go. Okay. All right, Hawaii.
Do you have any places that you like that aren't just super out there crazy? Just just a solid good restaurant.
Solid good restaurant. Oh, God, what do I like? I mean, I go, I'm in Silver Lake. I go to Peru a lot. That's the vegetarian Indian place, even though I'm not vegetarian. I love that place. It's like an old living room.
Have you been to Little Pine, Moby's place?
I have, and I saw Moby there.
Oh, did you?
And
I've never seen Moby there. I'm there all the fucking every Sunday. Really? I go for brunch.
You're kidding?
And I've never seen him there.
Now, I thought it was really weird when you walk in. At first, I thought I saw Moby because the guy working the front desk looks just like Moby.
Yes.
And I was like, wow, that's like a weird animatronic Moby. But then Moby was there. I had some kind of pancake and it was delicious. Mm-hmm. And I need to go back there. I thought that place was great. I'll tell you, I had the in Atwater Village, I went and had a beet sandwich at Dune. Mm-hmm. If you've been, Dune's like the sandwich spot, and I was like, a beet sandwich? That doesn't sound delicious. This sandwich is amazing. I went back 2 days later and had
beets.
It again.
Really?
I used to hate beets as a kid.
I don't like beets.
And as an adult, I love beets.
You need this beets. I mean, there's some crunchy thing in there. I don't know what they do. That place is delicious.
And golden beets are really good, too.
Golden beets.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're what are those? Yellow beets. It's just like regular. It's just like, not just, but they're sweeter, I think, than red beets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
Trying to think of what the name of that diner-type restaurant is. I used to eat there a lot.
Where?
Silver Lake.
Oh, Silver Lake. I don't know Silver Lake restaurants very well.
Shit, why am Bright I... Spot?
Yes, Bright Spot.
Oh, yeah. Like Bright Spot.
I used to chow at a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, we got our fancy place, Winsome in Echo Park. I've got to say, I think it's worth the hype. The place is pretty delicious. You know, downtown. I had someone in town last week, and I brought them to Bacco Mercat downtown. I mean, that place is kind of like, to me, like... can't miss.
Yeah.
How often are you disappointed in the places that you pick?
For the culinaires? Only once. We went, one of the culinaires, Alexander the Steak, chose a place, Parrish downtown. Delicious restaurant, Parrish. Wonderful. Like the most edgy thing on the menu is like pork belly sliders. So you get like eight guys. We're all sitting there. People are like, what is this, like a bachelor party? I'm like, no, it's supposed to be like an adventurous dinner. But somebody picked like a really down the middle place.
Someone picked Subway.
Like. Yeah, it was in the infancy of the club, and then everyone's girlfriend is like, hold it, you went to a guy's dinner. Why didn't I get to go? You know what I mean? All of a sudden, like
it's
the
not like a
right,
thing.
Yeah. Right. Like if it's not a weird restaurant, then everyone's, you know, it's kind of like, you know, women are invited, but usually as a special guest, or otherwise would be a couple's dinner.
Right.
So that was a little disappointing. But then he made up for it when we went to Cafe Artiste in Little Saigon. That was his call. So the pressure was on for him to really blow minds that night.
Have you guys considered, have you heard of these flavor tripping parties?
What?
No. Yeah, I have to tell you about this too, guy.
Okay.
So there's this berry from Africa, I think. And I don't know where you order it. You can order it online. And if you take a bite out of it, it does something to your taste buds for an hour or so. And you taste things completely different. And
Lemons are sweet, for
lemons
example,
taste like very, very sweet. Something like just plain olive oil tastes like syrup.
Wow.
And hot chili peppers taste like you know, something completely different. Like all good stuff.
Yeah.
Like they were saying how they were even comparing it on the, I saw a New York Times article about it. It's big in New York.
Flavor parties.
Yeah, flavor tripping parties. So what flavor they'll do is parties. They had basically 8 or 10 people at this Soho apartment or whatever, and they gave them all a berry, and they had this plate of food, and they had all these random stuff. They had celery and yeah, and like just canola oil and just like really random bland food. And they were saying, oh, this tastes like donut syrup. And it's just, and you just, very strange. In Africa, they were actually using it to get people to eat healthier because it was like, it would make healthy, but it's very expensive. It costs like $20 per berry or something.
Oh man, I want to go.
But you should. All right, we gotta find out what the LA. That.
Yeah, let's do it.
The thing is, you'll end up eating stuff that's maybe like not like a lot of peppers, and like you think it tastes fine, but it's not so good for your like heartburn and stuff like that. So
yeah, as a culinaire, I actually have the group. I think I have the most sensitive stomach. So
oh really?
But you know, I don't tread carefully. I just go for it.
Yeah. Is there anything you won't eat?
I don't think I would eat any kind of, are spiders a delicacy? If that was a delicacy, I couldn't eat that.
No, okay. I
don't do that.
But you're pretty open.
Vacuum
otherwise.
Those up. It's just open. Not a good thing.
It's like crickets. Maggots. You would eat maggots?
Bugs.
Yeah, I don't know about that either. Maybe if they were called something else. Yeah, I've eaten plenty of crickets.
Okay.
Where else do we go? We went to, it's not an adventurous restaurant, but it's kind of weird, Opaque, where they blindfold you.
Oh, I've heard
Have
of
you
that.
Been there?
Is
that
it
was
fun?
Pretty weird. It was weird because I felt like it was, you know, the waiters are also blind, which is kind of interesting.
I feel bad.
I guess it felt like not that ventilated back there. Oh, no. So I was like, is this, because you don't know what the room looks like.
It's like an Inquisition going on.
Yeah, like you go into a restaurant, but in the restaurant they were having a singles mixer, and they're like, oh no, Opaque is in the back. So you kind of go into this dark room, and I was like, how many people are here? Is there some ventilation? What am I eating? So it was interesting. I'm not running to do it again.
Sounds like anxiety riddled.
I was a little sweaty, and you're like, "What am I?" It's interesting because it was very hard for me to tell if the food was good or not because what I'm putting in my mouth, I'm not sure which part of the dish it is.
Right.
So that's true.
Know, they're telling you what you're eating, but you're kind of like, grabbing and
tell you.
I think they tell you. Maybe I'm wrong. I think you have some idea.
I'm gonna pass. I don't know why.
You have some
that'd be interesting.
You have some idea, at least because of like allergies and stuff. So that you.
So don't die. Okay.
Yeah,
I'm
you
helpful.
Won't. You won't die. But it wasn't a. It was a so-so. It was like, a so-so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Last hard question for you, and then an easy one. What do you consider your biggest failure?
Oh my God! Do you have another hour?
Yeah.
So many. Well, I guess we're talking work-wise. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, since we talked about Queer as Folk, Rolling Stone was a failure because I feel like that was a missed opportunity.
Yeah.
I should have navigated those waters better. But I also think about Queer as Folk. I would have loved to have written a Queer as Folk script. At the time, I didn't really watch TV, and I wanted to get into movies. And, I found an agent, and I left, and I didn't push. I had a movie script. I didn't push it enough on my boss. And I thought, well, I'm the straight guy. But later they had straight writers. So I thought it would have been, now I'm like, it would have been really cool if I'd written a Queer as Folk script and I could have taken some more initiative, and I would love to have that in my back pocket. So that was a failure.
Okay.
That was a failure.
So if you could change something, that would be one of the biggest things you changed. It was just, Rolling Stone sounds like a big one too. What, in your ideal mind, right, if you had done Rolling Stone right, you'd been a Rolling Stone writer. Was that the goal, or was it something else?
No, I would have written a couple things. I'd at least have a few Rolling Stone bylines. And, maybe I'd have them on speed dial, call them up, pitch them something.
Right.
That wasn't what I wanted to do anyway, but, I was there, so
right.
I could have, maybe made a little more of that. I definitely have some other failures. I can't think of what they are off the top of their head. I mean, they're basically every day.
Do you think your failures, seriously, like, do you think that your failures like made you stronger or led you towards the right, like the path that you are currently on? Was that a factor in your life?
I think failures just in general hopefully do make you stronger. Unless you're obsessing about them nonstop. Hopefully the consensus among successful people who I respect is you take those failures and hopefully that's a motivator to get the next thing done without letting it just completely like destroy your life, but at least be like, well, I fucked that up, but that means I got to work double time to get this to happen, and hopefully that does happen or something happens. One of those things happens.
Yeah.
So you're not always looking over your shoulder of what could have been, whatever they call the metaphor of, forging the I'm not going to get it, whatever. That's like a blacksmith. And
yes.
You've got to.
Yeah. What is that called? It's not a dowel. No. Do you have a favorite charity?
I like Doctors Without Borders.
Okay.
I like Kiva, which is like the micro loans, although I've heard maybe those aren't like the total as amazing as, okay. I mean, I think there's, that's still a good charity, but, and I like Amnesty International. My nephew, I have a nephew with autism, so autism charities for research are always good.
Okay, let's do that one. $100, okay. Amnesty International, on behalf of Failing Up. And Duncan, thank you. Thank you so much for being
here.
For
having
me.
Really
appreciate your time and your patronage, everybody, for listening to Failing Up. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.